Welcome back to Switchcast Season 5. This is our season finale. This is going to be a bonus, I guess, double episode. We'll see how Ethan splits it up for you, but we're taking a month off and coming back for Season 6 in June. So we will miss you. I hope that we will also be missed.
I hope. What if everybody realizes that their life is better without Switchcast? That would suck. Please don't leave us.
Oh, that is my co-host Tyler Sanders, and Ethan Huffnagel is our executive producer. And let's see, we've got a lot of news to cover tonight, but of course we got to start with a warm-up lap, which is for our audio listeners only. And if you like the special treatment as an audio podcast listener, we're going to give you even more special treatment, but it'll cost you. We are on Patreon. That's right, switchcast.com/Patreon. That is not it, patreon.com/switchcast, although you're smart listeners, you would have figured that out. I have a little bit of verbal dyslexia, sometimes verbal diarrhea. Some people may
I think we got a lot critique. Of that one. That's why we got a podcast.
Yeah. anyway, I've been taking my probiotics.
Yeah.
Is that like, is there linguistic probiotics to where we... Or more laconic.
I think that's whiskey. It's alcohol.
That's the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Hey, anyway.
Anyway, so sign up for that. You will get exclusive access. You can watch live, participate live with us again like the old days, and we'll have some exclusive content on there as well, like bourbon discussions, if anyone cares about that. I know less about bourbon than I know about cars, which is... arguably a low bar.
That's all right.
But if you do enjoy this podcast and you want to help it grow, please share it, like it, write a review. If you know of a great sponsor, we're looking for to add some sponsors for season 6 as well. So if you know any that would be a good fit, that would be great. If that's you, reach out to us as well. Switchcast.live is the best way to do that. So let's start with a warm-up lap. Last week, we talked about overpriced cars, overhyped cars, and I forgot to put one on my list.
What could you possibly forgot?
That is, in my opinion, and maybe there's something I'm missing, the most overhyped, overpriced car out there. I didn't even know they went for this much until somebody asked me to find one, and I looked up the values. I was like, hey, are you sure you want one? They go for $500,000 plus.
What?
And they're like, yeah, we know. I was like, oh okay. Because I was floored. It is the 2014 Mercedes G500 Final Edition Cabriolet. They are rare, but I don't think G-Wagons are that good to start with. And a short wheelbase convertible one looks kind of funky. I mean, I guess if you know, want to tool around Miami and... look cool with the top down in a boxy SUV.
I like how ridiculous this is, but $500,000.
Oof. I got one for $700,000 with a straight face because it was federalized. And I'm like, because they didn't make them for the US market. So they're all show and display or federalized imports. Yikes. I don't get it. I don't get it. But, Tyler, your search for a dream car got a little energy this week. What did you find on Bring a Trailer?
There is a Japanese market 996.1 GT3 in white over black I don't know. There's something about it. Perked my eyeballs up. It could be my desperation that I'm just so tired
of
looking.
What's desperation about it? It's a low mile white Mark 1 GT3.
I want a Mark
II,
though.
It's not a club sport.
Like, I really want a Mark II.
I want you to want a Mark I.
This does look so good. I don't think there's any other color other than green that would speak to me this much on a Mark I. White just looks good. It's like a little baby race car. So I don't know. I'm going to keep eyeballs on it.
Speaking of verbal probiotics, what are we drinking tonight that help us out?
We've got some John J. Bowman in the old bottle, which it's the warm-up lap. Nobody can see it. But I've had this sitting in my closet for a while, and it's delicious.
It is quite good. You said it's Buffalo Trace that was produced somewhere else, bottled somewhere else?
Buffalo Trace Mash Bill 2 that they send to A. Smith Bowman in Virginia, and then they distill it a second or a third time, and then they age it with their barrels vertical for some reason. But it tastes pretty darn good.
Okay.
You get the little bit of appliness that you get out of some Asheville 2 stuff. Tasty.
Tastes like whiskey to me.
Way better than Blanton's.
There's a lot of things way better than Blanton's, but that's controversial. Okay, we're going to get in trouble right off the bat because we are talking politics. Again, we do not talk politics on this show unless it is car related, and this is very much car related. But we are going to talk about Trump and Biden because, well, they're at the center of this. Trump recently issued an executive order that requires truckers with a CDL to speak English. They have to pass a English proficiency test. I'm doing well already. Probably not. Especially since I don't even know what penultimate means.
You'd get to the penultimate question and just completely flunk.
And this is arguably controversial. Executive orders in general are quite controversial. I know that are allowed, but I think they have been way, way overdone by the past few presidents, regardless of their party. It seems crazy to me that they keep setting records for more executive orders than the last person than the last person.
Well, and they send a bunch to like undo things that the other guy did that they don't like to do stuff. They want to, it's a whole thing.
Yeah. Anyway, this one I think is good though. And it does undo something that the last guy did, which I believe the data shows is bad, right? So we've talked about the rampant issues with the trucking industry. Most notably, I mean, the joke is that it's all, you know, Eastern European truckers that show up. They can't speak English and you just get, hello, I'm a driver. I can't do a proper accent, but anyway, I mean, that's the joke. They know like four things. Like, hello, I am driver. Can I use your bathroom? And
look, that second one's real important. I got to be honest, though, that we had a mutual friend of ours come up to me at a car show recently and say that our podcast is the reason that he doesn't want to ship a car. He's too scared. He's like, there's so many bad things.
I was trying to help a guy this week ship a car and I gave up. And this is actually showing we've learned firsthand why this the impact that this executive order is having already. But let's rewind a bit. Right. So Trump's executive order would state that if they do not pass an English proficiency test when they get inspection by a DOT, so they get pulled over, sometimes random, and they, you know, go through a safety inspection, they go through a driver inspection, they inspect their logbooks. Well, they would also have to be able to speak, read, understand English as part of this. And if they cannot, they get an out of service violation, which puts them out of service temporarily. The problem is there's not enough DOT people enforcing this stuff to, I think, really make a dent. We've already seen this with all the fake trucking companies out there that are running without markings or switching up their markings in between stops, that are running duplicate logbooks for 18 different companies that they're all contracting with.
Yeah.
Who knows whether or not their insurance is covering the truck that they're driving. I mean, it's the wild, wild west. But let's back up to 2016. Part of the reason I believe that it is the wild, wild west is a different executive order by President Biden. Now, again, we're not here to say Trump versus Biden, whatever. We're not camping in a political camp. This just happens to be related to trucking and what Biden did in an effort to solve a problem which does exist, which is not enough truck drivers out there with CDLs. There's a huge demand for truckers with CDLs. He made it extremely easy to get CDLs.
I was going to say, don't you have to have a CDL to operate a semi-truck?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And just like every other trade, there's a big demand for, you know, qualified people to do this. So they, the Biden administration, I believe, according to this article on Zero Hedge, they bragged that they had added more than 800,000 drivers to the network, basically 876,000 new drivers into the market. According to the stats they quote on here, it looks like it was more like about 300,000. Between 22 and 2025, the trucking industry gained about 300,000 drivers. So it looks like that stat was exaggerated. However, it was in a decline already. And all of a sudden, since 2016, they've gained 300,000 drivers. The allegations of this article is that it was all what they said, non-domicile CDLs. So basically non-US citizens, they don't even have enough identification to get on a flight, but they can drive a truck. And the danger in this, there's dangers twofold. One is what I'm seeing as rampant in the trucking industry, which is theft after theft after theft. You have these companies that are basically shell companies, and they're rebrokering loads to other companies that may or may not be real. They're, you know, they're shipping drivers over from overseas. This is not anecdotes. This is, I've talked to people. I mean, we see it firsthand, but I've also talked to people who are from those countries, and they said, yes, they're advertising over in those countries, basically like, come to America. It's super easy to get a CDL, and here's all the money you can make. Oof. And they just ship them over with promises of big money. And a lot of them are criminal organizations, and they're taking the cars to the port. They're taking them to Mexico. Like, it's crazy. The other problem is that if you can't speak or read English, you cannot understand road signs. And this was brought up. Now, is this the cause? We don't know, but it's certainly a pretty flagrant accident. I think we've all heard about the crash in Texas, Austin, Texas, where a foreign truck driver who could barely speak English, and that's, again, that there's video that a bystander took of this truck driver right after the crash, basically showing the guy, asking him, do you know what you just did? And the guy just, he couldn't understand anything. And it was, I think it was foggy situations. It was a slowdown. And this trucker didn't slow down at all. I mean, he plowed through tons of cars. The accident scene is, I mean, it's devastation. It looks like a tornado went through. 5 people were killed, 11 more were injured, and the guy couldn't speak English. So this is obviously being used to say that this is the root of the problem. This wouldn't have happened if this guy had been able to read the hazard signs, know what was going on, and or have been better trained in a semi-truck. For that, I'm happy about this executive order. Now, again, enforcement's going to be tough. I was told by some truckers that next week coming up is DOT week, which is basically when they're all on duty. They are just, you know, out there pulling everybody over. And we've been trying to get a few cars shipped this week, and it's been almost impossible.
Really?
Really. Like, we are feeling the effects of this already.
So it's like there's just not everybody's parking at home for like a week.
I mean, we're still getting calls from all the shady truckers.
Yeah.
But when I'm running their stuff, all their companies are intertwined. It's all these different companies. But then their VIN numbers, when I do the searches on the NHTSA website, it's like, well, that VIN number was inspected for this trucking company over here, and they called us trying to get the load too. Like, are you guys just all the same company using one dispatcher? Which the answer is kind of yes.
That's wild.
It's absolutely wild. It is wild. But yeah, we're already seeing, like, I couldn't get a car from New Jersey to Ohio, which is where all the trucks run. They go from the port to the Midwest. 2 weeks I've been sitting on this car trying to get it moved.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. So Yeah. And anecdotally, I was reading some comments, and apparently in Ohio, to get a regular driver's license, you can have a translator read your driving test questions to you. So this is not just CDLs. The bar is so low to get any sort of driver's license in America, let alone a CDL, that, like we've said this before, things have got to change. It's not just speaking English. It's knowing the rules of the road, knowing how to handle a car properly, not just like, oh, I can back into these cones and I got my license. Like the problem is bigger than just truck drivers.
Well, and I think that's kind of where I can't argue with the fact that if you can't read or understand English, all of the road signs will be impossible. And if your job is to navigate the roadways, that is a huge detriment. But I feel like this doesn't, I feel like there is more that could be done to potentially solve the problem if it was actually, I don't even know what's possible with an executive order, because it seems like everything is and then nothing is at the same time. But I feel like the training, the certifications have become so easy to get for driver's license, for CDLs, for everything, that is the real problem. And it feels like this is a half-hearted attempt to solve the problem that I think is very attractive to a base of people. And that's maybe why it was done.
Okay. It's attractive to me because I think it's not just a safety thing. If they put enough of these guys out of service and can, you know, potentially permanently ban them from holding CDLs, that could potentially cut down on the crime as well, the thefts. The problem is that I don't think the consequences are enough. If I was making the executive order, I would go back and basically require everyone to get recertified. That would kill the trucking industry for a minute.
Yeah.
But I'm like, if you look at the stats on this Zero Hedge, right? So they showed a chart from ATU, American Truckers something or other, not university, but they have large truck crash data. And the FMCSA, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, issued a memo around about 2016 that basically said, here's our benchmark baseline of how many truck crashes is acceptable. And since 2016, when Biden issued his order or his act in order to, you know, make it easier for truckers to get CDLs, the fatal crashes have spiked. Every single year since then, they have been over the benchmark line. And they hadn't even matched a baseline. Well, 2015, it was at the baseline. 2008, it was at the baseline. Every other year since then, it was below. So the curve is going up.
Well, and I should have looked this up beforehand, but was the language requirement the only thing changed in 2016 or whenever it was, or were there other things that were reduced, made easier at that time?
I don't know all of the details of like what the specifics were, but it essentially just made it easier to get your CDLs.
Because I know I read the fact sheet put out by the White House about this, and this really is just focused on the language portion, where I feel like, again, I don't want to minimize that as the is a huge impact if you're navigating roads with signs filled with the English language and needing to communicate with potentially emergency personnel or, you know, even folks that you're doing business with. But I feel like something needs to be made more difficult for folks to even get these licenses in the first place, because they obviously are not fit. You know, a lot of these folks, regardless of language, just don't seem to be fit to be operating a truck. And that's my concern, is like, obviously the theft is rampant and everything else, but the safety of other people on the road, like I have just been seeing some similar things. I have watched trucks just behave very strangely on the highway. Correct. I was on the turnpike and it was pouring and I'm going like 65 because I'm not trying to rush. And two trucks are like racing to get past me like 90 miles an hour. And I'm like, that's horrifically unsafe.
I am actually less concerned about the trucks going 90 miles an hour if right? So and this is a nod to the old school truckers that, you know, did it with, you know, skill, caffeine, and cocaine, right?
I don't know if I want my truckers to be coked up.
No, no. However, the old school guys who were on the CB radio, like back then, their version of breaking the law was, all right, well, I'm running overweight or over my hours or whatever. But those guys were born to do that. They could drive for 48 hours straight and just like not blink an eye. And their version of breaking the law was, you know, they get on the CB and they find out about the chicken coops, which is trucker speak for way stations, right? So they can avoid them and keep rolling. Now they're all speed limited to 62 miles an hour. They've got all the e-logs, stuff like that. But man, it's kind of like speed limits, right? Where it's like, I want all these other laws enforced for safety, but not really speed limits. Because a really good focused driver who's well-trained and focused on driving is safer at 100 miles an hour than the mom texting at 60 in her Escalade. And I think that's the same case with the truckers. I'm not so much worried about the guys going 90 because they're probably in an old truck that they've owned for 30 years that isn't speed limited and they've been hauling for 50 years. And they actually know what the frick they're doing.
But those aren't really the people I'm concerned about. It's all the folks that just don't have any sort of training or skills or ability, and it's just so easy for them to get a license now, regardless of this specific point. It's like, I feel like we're missing the forest for the trees with the topic and the wording of this order. It's like, it's absolutely a problem, but let's not focus on just one part of it.
Sure. The other issue with it in terms of enforcement is when I'm looking up these trucking companies, and I looked up a bunch of them today trying to get a vehicle moved, every single one of them had the same story. Not only were they had like 50 different companies that were related to them by VIN number sharing on an inspection or address, you know, I literally saw one company that had 36 different trucking companies registered at their same address. 36.
Wow.
And a whole bunch of them were their carrier authority had been revoked. So it's like, oh, they just start a new company. Same thing with the drivers. You give them an out of service violation, I just friggin' give them a different driver's license and print a new one and put them under this company instead. They're already working for seven different companies. We had somebody call a dispatcher. They had to pause and look up which company they were calling on behalf of because they have so many. Like, it's such a shell game already that until you really go after that, it's a drop in the bucket. I think it's a start, but you're right. We have to make CDLs far more difficult to get. Shrewd negotiator.
Yeah.
We got one sent in to us, and we usually make fun of people for attempting to negotiate really hard. We got one via Facebook Marketplace. What did we have for sale? BMW E30 M3 for sale.
Nice.
And 75 grand, which people in the know said that's a very good price. And it was, because it sold within like 2 weeks. Well, this person literally just sent us a photo of a crack pipe.
Nice. That's good.
Just
like
a photo.
That.
So
I don't think we can show that on the video, by the way.
Nope.
I'll blur it out.
Just put up the, yeah.
I'll pixelate it. You'll know it by the shape. But.
Right. Well, man, if I had a dollar based on.
Hey. It's a family show.
That's why we're blurring it out.
I do love the thought of just the photo superimposed on us blurred, and it's also blurred. Like, that's so good. Please do that.
Just do a fully pixeled screen. They won't even know what's up
it's
there.
It's like, wow, you wouldn't believe it.
My guys, I love them. They just gave a laugh emoji and said, clearly you don't know cars. I'm like, whoa, strong response.
Nice.
But yeah,
put him in his place.
Exactly. So the guy goes, nah, with that mileage, it's like a 40K car at most, even with how clean it is. Very beautiful car. Not 75K, though. No way. So my guy said, please send us comps of this car so we can understand the market and price ours accurately. I'm like, oh, man, they trolled. This isn't even me. I'm the smart aleck
here.
I was like, So I guess he responded a while later. Seems like he went and looked up comps and he's like, you're right. I don't know crap. My bad, dog. Have a great night.
That's amazing.
Never seen that on Marketplace before.
The world needs more people like this guy. I love his joke. Just the photo of the crack pipe is so good. But nobody, being able to acknowledge that you messed up.
Nobody ever acknowledges that, and myself included.
Oh, yeah, we can't do that here. We got episodes to record.
Heck, yeah. We got to finish our penultimate season episode.
Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick-themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
All right, let's talk about less political things. Cash for clunkers.
That's still kind of political, Doug.
No, it's not. This is literally just about cars. Well, I mean, listen, the government has their hands in everything. If they didn't, we would not have airbags.
Or roads.
Yeah. You know, actually, it's interesting you bring that up because in the early days when there was the Lincoln Highway Association, I think it was called, and it was people and companies trying to get the Lincoln Highway built, which was the first coast-to-coast highway. And people were trying to get the government to pay for it, including Henry Ford, who stood to benefit the most from this being built and made a ton of money off of cars. But no, let's get the government to pay for it. So, yes, it's always been a give and take. You know, Elon Musk is not the first person to use government to his advantage to get tax breaks for selling his cars and then profiting massively. Like it's as old as government itself. But I think the government enjoys that because of the power they get from that. Anyway, cash for clunkers, government program. Intended to not only not stifle, to invigorate the economy.
There we go.
In 2009, because we were in a global recession, but also get arguably polluting vehicles off the roads and get people into newer, more fuel efficient vehicles. Now, there's a whole different argument there in terms of whether or not keeping your old vehicle or getting a new one is better for the environment. But we've discussed that already, and that's not tonight. But they offered up to $4,500 cash that they would give to the dealers, that the dealers could give to people who could get their vehicles in. I think they just had to have a valid title. I don't remember. Did they have to run?
My guess is no, but I don't actually. I think they didn't run. I gotta be honest.
I don't think they had to run. They just had to get them there. They had to have a valid title, and they had to get 18 miles per gallon or worse EPA city mileage,
which is not hard, I think, for some of these cars.
I was surprised at what cars were on the list that got as bad as 18 miles a gallon back then.
Speaking of the list, I was perusing the internet and came across an article from The Drive in 2022 where they linked to a Google sheet that somebody ripped off of. They ripped a spreadsheet off of an old government website that is archived on the Wayback Machine that has a list of all the cars. And so I think it would be interesting to kind of look at what actually went.
Yes.
I feel like it is. Maybe I was living under a rock, Doug, but I feel like a lot of people think that all of these amazing cars got junked.
Did you have your driver's license in 2009? Tyler is not qualified to speak on this topic.
All right.
Owned a car that would have I would have made money on this deal. I owned a Ford Taurus SHO that I bought for $3,000, I think, in 2002-ish. I was really happy to sell it. I think I got like two G's for it in a couple years later.
You'd get a lot more now, unless it was a pile of garbage.
It was kind of. It was a rebuilt title and all that. All SHOs were a pile of garbage, even the good ones. But somebody asked us to say, like, hey, how has this impacted the market currently, right? Big complaint is there's no cheap used cars out there. You can't buy anything. It's like $5,000 will barely get you a decent running car anymore.
It's impossible. And I actually, after looking at this and doing some research, I actually don't think this made any sort of difference in used car prices whatsoever.
Spoiler alert. Me neither.
Dang it. Doug, we talked about this. We're supposed to argue.
On this one, there's not real philosophy here. We're just looking at data. All right, let's look at the data, Tyler. We've got a big spreadsheet here. 677,000 cars.
Yes. Well, I think to even some stats, I think. So I pulled up, and I'll make sure Ethan has this so the video viewers can see the chart. But there is a Bureau of Transportation Statistics website that shows annual U.S. motor vehicle production. That the Excel sheet even has a little chart in it for us that's pretty nice and slick. And what it shows is a humongous dip in 2009 of sold vehicles, sold passenger cars in the U.S. So for context, I'll try to describe this because for the audio listeners, 2008 was the first year where there were under 5 million cars, passenger cars sold since before these statistics were even started, as far as I can tell. No record in this shows under 5 million cars sold. And 2008...
And that's new vehicles, correct?
Correct, new vehicles.
Because I'm looking at a chart that says total vehicle sales, 16 million in 07, 13 in 2008.
That's huge. And that is probably related.
Big dip.
Huge dip.
3 million dip.
So the years of 2008, 2009, 2010, and 2011 all were under 5 million new passenger cars sold every year. So if you kind of do some guesstimations, if we assume 5 million is kind of the average, we lost 4 million cars over those 4 years-ish.
Yep.
That would have been in the used market that could be cheap, that realistically around that time would probably still be pretty reliable.
That's why 997.2 911s are so yes. valuable. And not only do they not have bore scoring issues, but they're rare.
And whenever I see a 997.2 Carrera, I kind of freak out because nobody who had the money bought the base model. Like that market just got destroyed. So you never see any.
GT3 RSs were below sticker. Who would have thought?
Wild.
Yeah, the chart I'm looking at, it shows it took until 2014 to get back to pre-2008 sales levels.
That is huge.
But then if you look at it again, 2020, huge drop, 8 million cars not produced.
That's nuts.
Over the whole COVID, supply constraint issue.
For sure.
Right? So it took until 2024 to get back. And in 2024, we are literally just back at 2007 levels.
Yeah, we were selling a ton of cars in the mid-2000s.
Yes, we were.
Before 2008. Holy crap.
Right. So 677,000 vehicles taken off the market by the data, not one dent. The global recession and COVID, millions and millions of cars, boof, not on the market.
And I would like to argue that around the 2008 to 2012 timeframe, that was a period in cars where they had technology, but there was less involvement from emissions requirements or technology advancements that kind of make them more complicated. So they should kind of just run for a very long time or be easily fixed. And I think that is more of a detriment than most of these cars that got crushed.
I would argue the opposite. And
really?
Looking at this list, the late 90s and early 2000s were a really bad period for a lot of manufacturers. It was good for some things. You know, was a GMT 800 platform.
Yeah.
The OBS Suburbans and pickup trucks, those things were indestructible. We talked about that last week. Man,
we learned
German
car
Mercedes in the late 90s and early 2000s were crap. That was a bad period for them. Audis, not real good either.
But I feel like didn't your normal like transportation stuff, like domestically at least, keep running? I mean, if it rusted away.
I don't know, man. There's there was a lot of North Star engines made around that time.
That was early 2000s, wasn't it? Didn't they stop by then?
There was a lot of rust. There's some really bad cars on it. Like, I'm looking at the list going, these really were clunkers. Nobody is missing a lot of these cars. Late 90s Cadillac DeVilles, Cadillac Cateras, Buick Roadmaster. Okay, maybe some people are missing Buick Roadmasters, yeah. Right? But
well, and I was talking more about the cars from the reduction in new production were reliable, not the cars from this list was all kind of.
You're saying that is what impacted it, yes. Versus and are like, we missing a whole ton of cars?
A 10-year-old car now, well, actually, we're probably like a 13-year-old car now is what really would be good transportation for a lot of people that just there's just less of those. But on the list, there was a single Z3, and that could have been Ethan's. That could have been his dream. Could use that in his wedding. And it's gone. Poof.
You know what the biggest travesty of this whole list is?
I'm so excited.
It's right at the top. This actually is the reason that college kids today cannot find great, used, reliable cars.
Is it all the Acura Legends?
Yes, it is. 2,247 Acura Legends.
Really
gone.
Depressing. Honestly,
destroyed.
It's so sad. So one thing I always wondered, Doug, was how many Porsches died during this?
That I saw none.
There was 11.
Cayennes, all Cayennes.
No,
right?
There was 5 928s. Those guys won. They guarantee you.
There are
you.
Still some 928s that people would be happy to get $3,500 yeah. for today.
Guarantee you those had to be towed to the dealerships. And 6 944s. That's it. There was no 911s. There was no, I theorize that some 924s would have died. I think those maybe just rusted away. None of those. Only 928s and 944s. 123 Corvettes died. And ooh. They were all C4s. Every single one.
There was a lot of onesie twosie cars as well, too. I think it was people like the Radwood fans. Put myself in that yes. camp, are upset that maybe some cool classic cars died.
100%.
Didn't happen. There was one Nissan 300ZX.
There was one RX-8.
They also won.
That's not Radwood era, but like there was a single RX-8.
And one FD RX-7.
Yes.
So there really were no decent classics destroyed.
I didn't count how many FCs, but I'm just glad that of the 367 RX-7s that did die, they didn't live long enough to become like ratted out straight pipe drift machines. It just depresses. I wanted an FC for so long and they're all crap.
One notable thing on here, there was 11 Isuzu Viacrosses destroyed.
No, I didn't even look. What?
Out of 4,100 total production, that's a significant yeah. percentage. I think people want those back.
I did see that 42 Mercours lost their lives, and our mutual friend Tim from the auto studio is still sad to this day, I guarantee it.
There was a lot of 80s and 90s Jaguars, too. Again, no big loss there.
Yeah.
Jeeps, there was a ton of Jeep Cherokees yes. on there.
Those people did all right.
Overwhelmingly American cars on this list, which really doesn't say that much because, listen, it was an era where American dealerships and American cars dominated here. And, I mean, there was just more of them. So,
yeah. Something that might make Dan in the audience sad is there was 21 Peugeot 505s that died.
That's all?
Yeah.
They were all dead before then. They couldn't even get them out of the field.
Oh, they're all
they
stuck.
They could not get them out of the field.
There were 91 M3s and 91 M5s that died. And I feel like the M5s are actually a real big loss. The M3s, I think, might have been all E36s. But the M5s really hurt.
Yeah. The other thing I looked at was like the newest cars. Because I'm like, how bad did a car have to be? So this happened yeah. in 2009. So I looked at 2008 model year cars.
Is it the RX-8?
No. No, there was one Saab 9.3 Aero.
Oh, big sad.
Makes sense. One Nissan Frontier. 7 Mercury Grand Marquis Flex Fuel.
Yeah, yeah.
One Crown Victoria Flex Fuel, three Dodge Avengers, two Ford Explorers, one Ford F-150, and one 2008 Ford Mustang.
Seriously?
How bad. They must have wrecked a lot leaving cars and coffee. And then they're like, yep, all right.
Yeah, just get it in there. It's a clunker now.
Oh, you know what probably happened? They didn't mean to trade it in. They had a car show at the dealership. It tried to leave, wrecked it back in, and they're like, well, give me $4,500 bucks.
It's toast. I do wonder if that was like somebody's track toy and they just entirely binned it and took it into the dealership. I do think, though, Doug, my favorite car, the winner of Cash for Clunkers, is the one guy that got rid of a TVR 280i.
Oh, yes.
A single TVR. Absolute winner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was no Honda Civics on that list because, again, 18 miles per gallon, that precluded them. But I was surprised that the Lexus ES300 was on the list. But they were right on the cusp at 18 city miles per gallon. Yeah, those are good cars. And every Lexus LS400 on that list, I shed a little bit of a tear because the 90s LS400s were one of the best boats ever made. So we did have a few losses there, but really no big loss to the overall market. With that, let's go to our plate to sample game. We take great or terrible vanity plates submitted by listeners or seen by us and try to, well, name that stereotype by guessing what vehicle it's on. Now, Tyler, I get a consolation point from last week.
Why is that?
Because you said that the Manimal plate was not a vehicle with an animal in its name, because I was like Viper, Shelby, something like that. But it was a Ram truck.
Huh.
Last I checked, a ram is an animal, and it's a male one, too, so it's a manimal. It's a male sheep.
Doug, we're keeping points?
Yes.
That's new to me. What?
Yes. But back to that, right? Male sheep, ram.
Uh-huh.
So I wonder if the guy's wife has a plate U-Haul on her minivan.
This guy brought me all the way back here just for that.
Get it? You?
Yes.
But yes, we are keeping score. It's somewhat arbitrary. I think I have 23 Stanley nickels and you have 12 Schrute bucks.
The Schrute bucks are worth more though, right? Like a buck is more than a nickel.
I don't know what the conversion rate is.
Ethan's got 12 shillings over there too, so I don't know.
I think it's the same as a ratio of unicorns to leprechauns. Yes.
Sweet. There it is. All righty, who's
Tyler
up first?
Didn't take the setup there, so I had to set myself up. you go first.
All right.
License. This is brought to you, as always, by Soul and Spine, soulandspine.com.
All right. Comes to us locally from Mr. Dan in the audience. SPGETI, spaghetti.
Is that Dan's Alfa Romeo?
No, but it would be a good plate for his Alfa Romeo.
Is it a Fiat?
Nope.
Is it a Ferrari?
Yeah, but like what kind of Ferrari?
458.
No.
430.
No.
I don't know.
It's a 348.
Oh, okay.
Yellow at a Raisin Cane's? Yeah.
Sweet.
Chicken Run in the spaghetti mobile.
Okay. Dad Boss. This one comes to us from Vanity of South Dakota.
There's more Vanity of Instagrams.
Yeah, they've been sending a couple.
Dad Boss, this is a Suburban.
Nope.
It is a, what is this, like a Honda Odyssey?
Nope.
Is it okay? Whatever a Mercedes SUV.
Nope.
Okay.
Boss is on a Kia Optima.
Nice.
Little sedan.
Heck yeah. Oh, I was thinking like they needed to carry the children around or something. That didn't work. Next
maybe,
up for you.
Maybe it's like those self-employed people that say they're CEOs, maybe he like has a dog or one kid and he's like, I'm a dad boss.
Yeah, that
boss
might be that
myself.
Kind of, next, up for you, it's Yeah Toast.
Yeah Toast?
Yeah.
Is the whole thing?
YEATOST. And they have a sticker on the windshield that says something about a toaster.
I don't know. Is it the Ferrari?
This is a bit of a deep cut.
Ferrari 250 GTO bread van.
No, that is so good.
Okay, well then
that would be amazing. It's a Honda Element because it looks like a toaster.
Okay, I was trying to think what vehicle looked like a toaster, but the bread van was a. Sorry,
that was really good. That deep cut, but that was good.
All right, this comes to us from John on Instagram. Capitalism.
Boy, this could go a lot of different directions. Is this like a Shelby GT500?
Nope.
Is it like a GMC Yukon Denali? Nope. I keep guessing that for things. It ain't going to be that. What is it?
A matte black Mercedes G63.
Oh, yeah.
Appropriate.
That's yeah, I should have got that.
Appropriate. I wonder how many times his car's been keyed.
So you're really just putting it out there. Next up for you comes up to us from Jeff B. Thank you for submitting all your great plate ideas. Sorry it took so long to get you in here.
This is one of the overseas ones?
Yes.
All right.
This is P-I-E-N-S. At least I think it's an I. That's what I'm reading it as.
P-N's.
P-N's, yeah, sort of.
Okay.
And it's separated, so it's a UK plate with it's the P-I
Mercedes
or whatever.
Mercedes AMG GT.
No, it could be a 1-2, I guess. I don't actually know.
A 1-2? Yeah.
No, like a P-1 instead of a P-I. I don't get it.
1-2-3?
All right.
You know I guessed AMG GT for that plate, right?
How what?
I feel like they are somewhat phallic in appearance. I can't get over that.
Honestly,
that
they call. Kind of are. Just long extended.
I don't know.
It's a McLaren P1.
Oh. So my mind was in the gutter.
Yeah, Doug, come on. It was P1 ENS. How could you possibly be
thinking
about that?
Okay, this one from Dave Marr, BMW grad.
BMW Brad.
Grad.
Grad.
BMW grad.
Grad.
Graduate.
Graduate. Oh, did they graduate from BMWs? Are they into Porsches now? Are they into Mercedes now? It's a 911.
No, I'd say they got their GED because it's a 718 Cayman.
I was so close, though.
It is a GTS. I'm sorry. It is a GTS. It's not the Turbo 4. So
I'm so invigorated.
The GTS depends what year it is because they did the 6 and the 4 depending on the year. So
did you buy a big Subaru or an actual Porsche?
Yeah.
Next up for you, Big Tree.
Sequoia.
Yes, it is.
Yes,
so good.
I can do wordplay.
Thank you, Josh S.
All right. I saw this one on the way to school today. I think it could be two things. Letter D, W-E-L-T-H. So it's either 4D wealth, like four-dimensional wealth, or Ford wealth.
What's the most expensive Ford? Is it an Excursion? Or is it just a Lincoln?
They don't make the Excursion anymore.
Expedition? Is that what they make now, the big one? Is it an Expedition?
No.
What the heck could this possibly be?
Cadillac Escalade.
What? I guess 4D wealth?
I don't know. Maybe it's one of those like 10X programs or something like that.
Yeah. To close out for you, I've got B8 Mobile.
Eight Mobile.
So that's what it reads as, but I'm pretty sure looking at this car right now, it's supposed to mean Batmobile.
So it's not an Alpina B8.
No, it is an all black car that I don't really think deserves this plate.
I don't even know.
It is a Lexus RZ450E with Baitmobile. Baitmobile?
Maybe it's cop bait?
I don't get it.
It's trying. Wild. I mean, the RZs are kind of all the new Lexuses are pretty aggressively styled, but
it's got
not
little
a
fins.
Batmobile.
It's like it's got ears on the top of it. There is a bat sticker, so there are supposed to be Batmobile, like a Batman like logo thing. But yeah, it's just this Baitmobile.
Baitmobile. All right, last one for you from Drew Humphrey. Great one to close out the season. Sexy mommy, M A M I, sexy mammy. Sexy Mammy, that's what it is.
Is this a Nissan Altima?
Yes, it is! Oh my God, what? With dents, lots and lots of dents.
Oh, love it. Dents on dents on dents on dents.
How could it be anything else?
Perfect.
This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. Check out their selection at sheffieldwatches.com and mention that you found them on Switchcast. GM has recently issued a giant recall. Now, recalls are not typically, well, they're always newsworthy because somebody's got to make an article, but they're not usually worth more than the headline, right? Tesla had a big Cybertruck recall lately. And oh my gosh, look at these giant, now just 17 bajillion Cybertrucks recall. And it's like a, you know, software patch, something like that, right? So there's millions of recalls, vehicles recalled every year. However, this one's pretty big. 600,000 vehicles with the 6.2 liter V8 engine.
That's a big recall for a big engine.
Yeah.
Lots of liters.
It's not a throttle body or ECU or something like that. It is connecting rod and crankshaft engine components may have manufacturing defects that can lead to engine damage and engine failure, according to the NHTSA notice. And this comes to us via NAIDA. Lots of acronyms here. Engine failure, 600,000. And it's interesting to my buddy Frank Comar, great mechanic. My parents were looking at a late model Escalade, Suburban, something. And I don't follow the late model stuff that closely.
Yeah,
unless it's a specialty car. Yeah. It's not my thing, right? And so they were like, hey, what about this? I'm like, I don't know. I got to call Frank. Frank's like, no, don't buy that. 6.2 is junk. And that was like 3 months ago, 6 months ago. So I'm like, all right, good to know.
It's kind of interesting. When I was doing some research for this, I noticed a bunch of Reddit posts from like 4 months ago of people like, hey, is something up? Like, and then the comments are filled with people like, yeah, my engine was toast.
Right. You found an article from The Drive that is a little bit even more damning than 600,000 vehicles recalled for potential engine failures.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
So the article from The Drive posted, I believe, it's like a week or a week and a half ago. Nearly 30,000 GM V8s had already failed before they were recalled, which is wild. So they go on to say that their service network has struggled to keep up with the demand for the V8 engines, which I don't know how much I'd want to put another one in unless they've
fixed the problem. What else are you going to put
problem, in? I guess.
LS swap the world. What if my LS failed? It's not an LS. Okay, I know, but you know.
But it seems that NHTSA launched its investigation after nearly 350 customer complaints. So I guess the barrier is pretty low to get them to like kick into action, which is pretty cool. But as it's like I'm steering a big ship, things take a while to get to the surface. But the company amassed nearly 30,000 reports of L87 V8s that failed due to this defect between April 29th of 2021 and February 3rd of 2025, which is a long period of time to just be sitting on V8s blowing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I think is really interesting, this is across a bunch of engines, across a bunch of different GM products from 2021 to 2024. What is interesting is that those vehicles were made with that engine in 2019 and 2020. But those years are not included in the recall.
What do you know? I have another article that I was going to talk about that seems to fit in perfectly here.
Interesting. So there is a specific reason. They did a detailed analysis, teardowns of engines, and we talked about the rod bearing damage resulting from sediment contamination in the crankshaft, oil galleries, and connecting rods. Additionally, some crankshafts produced have exhibited out-of-spec dimensions and inadequate surface finishes. And
that's
this stuff,
a problem.
Real big problem. Over time, leads to a lot of accelerated wear.
My doctor told me that. I got to keep my crankshaft in balance.
Exactly. So I think it's interesting that it was only... okay, here it is. Sorry, I've been looking for it in the article. That the GM's engineering team identified a specific build window between March 1st of 2021 and May 31st of 2024, during which an increased rate of engine failure was tied to specific manufacturing defects.
Gee, what happened before 2021?
Mm. You know,
everybody was paid to not go to work until they couldn't go to work. And oh gosh, we had a massive labor shortage and chip shortage and... Escalades are going off the line without heated seats. And let's see, cars.com has an article.
The last article I referenced was from GM Authority.
So. Yes, cars.com has an article quoting a JD Power study that the title of this, vehicles built during pandemic continue to frustrate owners. This is not just anecdotal. They've done surveys. And overall, the problems have increased. Vehicles made from 2022 to 2025, 6% to 200,000 problems per 100 vehicles. Now, that's not like 202 cars out of 100. It's, you know, one vehicle could have a lot of problems within a specified time frame. But that's a really big number. This correlates with its initial quality study for 2022 models, which showed a marked decline from the previous year. Today's three-year-old vehicles were built during a time when the industry was grappling with major disruptions, says J.D. Power's director of auto benchmarking. So having issues with software, that's a big part of it. Let's see, where's Chevrolet on this list? Chevrolet is... actually, not too bad. Chevrolet is near the bottom at 169 problems per 100. That's just Chevrolet, not Cadillac and GMC. Volkswagen's at the top with 285.
Oof.
Chrysler and Jeep are right behind them.
Oof.
Ugh. Then Audi, then Land Rover. Land Rover's never any surprise.
I just don't think they sold enough cars to be higher up on the list.
Yeah, so... overall, it seems like GM is doing quite well, compared to its competition until now.
They were.
Yeah.
I did find... so one thing that I thought was interesting, and I have another article from GM Authority that kind of talked about some of this. I'm going to be getting a bunch of GM ads now because I've just been on all these sites. Doug, I'm sure you've noticed that a lot of new cars use oil that is just practically water. Like 0W40, 0W20, like really lightweight oils.
I haven't noticed because I don't have new cars.
So I was at a store with a friend and he was buying some
oil.
My
wife does, but we'll get there because hers just had a big service too, her four-year-old car.
Oof. So what I thought was interesting is this article goes through some of the processes for the recalled vehicles. So they're going to be inspected by a GM technician in order to identify the presence of any of the issues that I mentioned that kind of go into causing that were manufacturing defects to cause this issue. Defective engines will be replaced, while engines that pass inspection will get a 0W40 oil change. Originally, the car is specified with 0W20. As well as a new oil fill cap reflecting the updated oil specification. Now, changing the oil that goes into your car is a very risky thing. Don't do this just willy-nilly because your engine is rated to run with a specific type of oil. But when you have a really lightweight oil, if anything is out of spec, it's offering potentially less protection against things rubbing up against each other, which is all your engine is doing. Obviously, Engine development technology has advanced significantly, and we're very good at building engines that are resilient.
That's why we don't have to warm up our cars anymore.
Doug, we're not talking about that again. But I think that these manufacturing defects are huge and would lead to failed engines regardless. But the fact that GM is recommending the fact that GM is recommending a slightly higher weight oil go into engines that are fine means that there is a chance that there could be accelerated wear regardless. These are in big vehicles that are under big loads that require, like, when oil gets too hot, it doesn't protect as well.
They are not either. People don't use trucks for truck things. That's why they all have 4-foot beds now.
I guess that's true.
They go to soccer practice in their $85,000 trucks.
But even that, doing anything that could...
But in theory...
There's the possibility that they're working. They're toting all this around. There's all these technology that's making the engine more complicated to start and stop. You know,
they're bringing furniture back from IKEA.
Yes. That's very heavy, Doug, if you get the real wood stuff, not the particle board. But either way, I think the oil thing is fascinating and is... newer engines are made to run on thinner oil, but I've always thought it's a bit strange exactly how thin we're getting. Because 0W20 is practically nothing.
I was thinking about this because I read 6.2 liter, right? And I know they're not the same engine, but it just, I'm like, man, 6.2 liter was a legendary engine. It was two legendary engines in GM's history. It was the Vortec and Vortec Max LQ9 and the L9H. In the pickup trucks and the Escalades and stuff like that, which were pretty stinking bulletproof. The Vortec 6 liter was a really good engine. And of course, my favorite 6.2 liter, the LS3, right? Yeah. Some really, really great engines from that era. And now we have, you know, 6.2 liters made with bad crankshafts out of balance and connecting rod failure. It's like, come on. And I know the LS7s had head issues, and like every engine has its Achilles heel. Every era has a big problem, but it just seems like, and the data supports this, right? The JD Power study supports that problems are on the rise. It just seems to me like manufacturers now are building cars, I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but it seems like there's planned obsolescence, right? That cars, like appliances, are being built for the warranty. And we've been told that by our appliance guy. It's like, yeah, it's just you get the best warranty you can because we don't fix them anymore. We just replace them. It's all computerized stuff. And
yeah.
You know, you can't have a refrigerator that lasts 20 years anymore. And I feel like the same is true with vehicles, that this is going to be a longer term issue. Our quality, our manufacturing processes, our technology in theory has all advanced. But if that's the case, why are problems also increasing as well?
It doesn't feel like any manufacturer makes anything to last. Like, you know, an old Mercedes. Luxury was
make
the quality.
Money if they can't sell you a new one.
Yeah,
but I feel like they're creating their own monster, because if vehicles have problems, right? People say, "Oh, gee, it's under warranty." Okay, but if a car has a lot of problems, whether or not you have to come out of pocket to fix it, people won't want them on the used market. So the customer's paying for that no matter what in accelerated depreciation. At the same time, vehicles' MSRPs have been skyrocketing.
Yeah,
so you have $100,000 trucks that are known to have engine failures across the board. Let's say you get one that didn't have the engine replacement and it has a heavier weight oil. People like you are going to go, huh, I don't think I want that on the used market because it's probably going to have an engine failure sooner than a different one. So I'm going to discount that. So they're creating this issue whereby people are just going to be buried in their cars. Now, maybe they're not, maybe the manufacturers don't care because it's like, well, it's the bank's problem, right?
Yeah.
As long as we get it off our books. But that's going to really kill the middle class. If new cars keep going up in price and down in quality, people, it's the largest purchase people make other than their house.
Well, and I think this might be related to, I'm not very educated on trucks, as we found out, I think, very recently. I think this I don't really have a way to show you any data that proves this, but I feel like this is part of the reason, other than just the typical cycle of car prices, that things from the 80s until the like early 2010s are getting so much more expensive, is because that was the, those decades were the last decades of reliable, well-built cars that you can keep fixing and keep them moving. You know, I've been thinking about potential replacements for my daily when it gets too old, but like, I think I'm just going to keep, it's a 2010, it's been doing great, and I'm just going to keep putting money into it to keep it rolling because it was just built in a different time. But what sucks about that is those will get more expensive, which means that the middle class is going to be priced out of them anyway, because all the people with more money are going to pay more money for them because they want the premium experience of a well-built car.
My 7.3 Excursion is going up in value every day.
Dog, it's an investment.
Every day. I mean, that one might be. It's future-proofed. since we're talking about General Motors stuff, we'll skip to the Corvette curmudgeon. We're not actually doing the Corvette curmudgeon, but I felt this was something that Kermit, it would give Hank a heart attack. So,
well, he's in bed already, so he's not listening, thank goodness.
I saw a post, a Corvette C6 was taken into Quick Fix Auto Repair in Garland, Texas.
That's where I'd take mine.
I once dated a girl off of eHarmony from Garland. Now open. That's never a good sign. They're fresh open. They literally just spray painted their address number on the side of the building.
Yikes.
And they were servicing a Corvette C6 and didn't put it on the lift properly, it appears, and it fell off.
Yikes.
Just like 90 degrees sideways. Ooh. Not like, oh, we loaded it too far forward or back. It just, fell yikes on its driver's side. And according to the post I saw, the shop does not have insurance to cover this sort of thing. Ooh. And are not planning on paying for it. Again, according to the post I saw, I'm yikes sure there's going to be legal proceedings involved.
How is that even?
Hank, sheesh, would have some things to say why are
you
about
taking
this.
This is why I don't take my Corvette to the shop.
You don't need to anybody service it if you don't drive it.
Yikes.
Golly. I mean, in fairness, if you took it, if like Hank would, he'd take it to the GM dealer and tell him not to drive it, not to wash it, whatever. But at least the GM dealer would have insurance for this type of thing. So, yeah, probably not the best idea to take your Corvette to Quick Fix Auto Repair with the address spray painted on the side.
Hey, my vibe.
Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.